and welcome to this milestone podcast. It's the 200th episode of the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodman, your host. This podcast is inspired by the L. Ron Hubbard Writers and Illustrators of the Future program, now in its 40th year, dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist, and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. This is a very special show in celebration of episode number 200. During the Writers of the Future Volume 38 Workshop Week, a live performance of L. Ron Hubbard's The Professor Was a Thief was presented to the contest winners and judges. Why The Professor Was a Thief? Because it is the L. Ron Hubbard story included in Writers of the Future Volume 38. So sit back and enjoy the performance. It's only 30 minutes and will be followed by a Q&A with the actors.
Welcome to the L. Ron Hubbard Theater's Golden Age Radio Hour featuring The Professor Was a Thief. By way of introduction, The Professor Was a Thief first appeared in 1940 in Astounding Science Fiction magazine, the publication that heralded the golden age of science fiction. The story was later included in an anthology entitled My Best Science Fiction Story, as chosen by 25 outstanding authors, edited by then well-known and prolific editor Leo Margulies. L. Ron Hubbard wrote an introduction to this story, and here are his words. Upon being asked to pick my favorite short story for this anthology, I found myself torn between two types of science fiction, the epic and the down-to-earth sort of thing. For example, to look into mankind's future without space travel is, in my opinion, to gaze upon a dead destiny, such as Wells depicts in his Time Machine. L. Ron Hubbard goes on to say, however, I do not mean to hold forth on a soapbox. I know there to be other prophets and science minstrels who will point the way and sing man to the stars. Let me consider then that other, that down-to-earth kind of science fiction story. The Professor Was a Thief may not be the great literature. In fact, I'm not even sure what great literature really is. A savant I once knew defined it to me as any writing which changed a trend or originated a form. On his authority, then, not mine, this story must be great literature, for it changed a trend. In the days when it was first published, all of the professors of science fiction were blowing up worlds, creating new universes, making bigger and better cataclysms. My professor had another idea. I thought it rather unique, if only because it did not follow an established motif. That is why I especially like this story. I hope you like it too. L. Ron Hubbard. And now we bring you tonight's feature presentation, starring Bill Cates, Chris Morroy, Travis Oates, Roger Scott, and I remain R.F. Daly. The Professor Was a Thief by L. Ron Hubbard.
Mr. Calborn said he had to see you right away.
You sent for me?
Yeah. Oh, I sent for you? Oh, yes. I remember now. Pending your retirement, you've been put on the copy desk.
My what?
Your retirement. We're retiring all employees over 50. We need new people and new ideas here.
Retirement? When? How?
Effective day after tomorrow, Pop. You are no longer with this newspaper. Our present Social Security policy
will pay me off about $20 complete.
Yeah.
But the hell with that. I brought this paper into the world, and it's going to take me out. You can't do this to me. I'm staying as a reporter.
All right. You're staying as a reporter, then. It's only 2 days.
And you're giving me assignments.
All right. Here's an article I clipped a couple months ago.
It was just some speech made a long while ago to some physics society. Oh.
Yeah, get a story on it.
Well, I'll show them. Call me a has-been. Well, I can make a story out of nothing. He thinks I can't do that, right? Well, I can. I'll get such a story that he'll have to keep me on and promote me. And raise my pay.
I wish I'd never heard the name Hannibal Pertwee. Now here I am in New Jersey, in front of a house not much bigger than an architect's model.
Oh, what's your business?
I want to see Hannibal Pertwee. I'm a reporter from the New York World Journal.
You are Mr. Brewhauer from the Scientific Investigator?
No. I'm from the New York World Journal. I came to get a story on this lecture you handed out a couple of months ago?
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah. You must see my garden. Mm-hmm. Such a wholesome originality and such gigantic trees.
Mm-hmm. What?
Why, over 1,000 feet tall, some of them. Of course, trees don't ordinarily grow to 1,000 feet. The tallest tree in the world is much less than that. There, now, I'm so sorry to walk you all over the place this way, but I have recently given my cars to charity.
Wait, I haven't been anywhere.
No, indeed not.
Yeah.
My garden is only a small portion of what I have yet to show you.
Oh.
Please come in. Oh, what an unusual cigarette case design.
Yeah, listen.
Fascinating. What a delicate mechanism.
Yeah.
You know, I've made several rather small things myself. Here is a car, which I spent much time constructing. The engine is quite perfect. See, it runs.
Oh.
Of course, it should get about 100,000 miles to the gallon. Therefore, if a car could make the trip and it could carry enough gas, then it could go to the moon. The moon is only 238,857 miles from Earth, you know. Now I should show you around. I wish to show you my trains.
Trains? No, Mr. Pertwee, I came about that lecture.
Lecture?
Yeah, that you made before the Physics Society. Something about moving freight.
Oh, the Pertwee elucidation of the simplification of transportational facilities is applying to the freight problems of the United States. You mean that?
Yes, that's it. Just some comment or other. I couldn't understand just exactly what it was all about.
Oh, there's nothing half so lovely as a train.
Oh, my. You got stations and semaphores and miniature rivers and underpasses and sidings and switches and, oh, a whole fleet of freight cars in a yard. Nearly every type of equipment is represented here.
Yeah. You must go now.
Look. Just give me some kind of an idea what you were talking about in that article so I can mention it in the newspaper.
Do you understand anything about infinite acceleration?
Well.
Or the fourth dimension?
No.
Einstein's mathematics?
No.
Then I don't think I can explain. They would not believe me. So you see, you wouldn't either. Good night.
Wait. Oh. I seem to be missing my cigarette case. Well, that story you sent me out on, I didn't think there was any story there. And you were right as far as the news was concerned, but human interest, oh.
You call this a story? Go back to the copy desk.
Hey, you look like you need a drink.
I do.
So, he's making it tough on you, is he? Dirty rat. Never mind, Pop. When better news prepper men are built, they'll all look like you. Something will break sooner or later.
I'm leaving tomorrow.
Say, look now. Don't quit under fire. You know what ails that guy? He's scared. That's all. Scared of most of us, and you in particular. Why, hell's bells, you belong in that chair. We're losing money, hundreds a day, and when it gets to thousands, the publisher himself will get wise.
I'm being laid off.
You?
Nah.
Oh, for God's sake.
Hey, give me a rewrite.
I'll take it.
This is Jensen. I'm up on the drive.
Ready?
Ready.
Okay. At 12:45 today, Grant's tomb disappeared.
Huh?
Get it down. The traffic on the drive was at its noon hour peak, and the benches around the structure were filled with people, right, which, without warning, a rumble sounded. The alarmed populace...
Okay, to hell with the words. Give me the story. Give me the story. How did it happen?
I don't know. Nobody knows. There are half a dozen police cars around here staring at the place Grant's tomb was. I was about a block away when I heard shrieks, and I came tearing down to find out the traffic was jammed up and the people were running away from the place while other people ran towards it. So I asked a nursemaid about it. She'd seen it happen. She said there was a rumbling sound, and then suddenly the tomb began to shrink in size, and in less than 10 seconds, it vanished.
Was anybody seen? They were monkeying with it?
Well, the chauffeur said he saw a little guy in a swallowtail coat tear across the spot where the tomb had been.
All right. How many dead?
Nobody knows if anybody's dead.
Well, find out.
How can I find out when everybody that was sitting on the steps and all completely disappeared? They're gone.
Ah, somebody's crazy. No bodies?
No tomb.
Okay, I got this much. You hoof it back there and get stories from the witnesses. Grant's tomb is gone. Get Columbia on the phone. We have to get a statement from someone that knows this stuff. You, Sweeney, grab an encyclopedia. See if there's anything like this that ever happened before. Morton, grab a camera. Get out there for some pictures. Dunstan, you go with Morton and find the relatives of the people who had vanished along with the tomb. Get going! Banner, start setting up an extra. We'll be on the street in half an hour. Second extra in an hour and a half with pictures.
Is this Pop?
Yeah, this is Pop. What are you waiting for?
Okay, half an hour it is.
All right. Louie, get some shots of Grant's tomb out of the files. Rush him down to composing. Who's this?
Freeman, grab your pencil.
Oh, okay. Got it.
The Empire State Building disappeared about 5 minutes ago.
Right.
I'm down at the 100th Precinct. About 3 seconds ago, a cop came staggering in with the news. I haven't had a chance to look.
Get down there. See. Grant's tomb vanished just before you were called.
Check.
Yeah. Empire State Building gone. Goodart, get a camera to the Empire State. It's disappeared.
Check, Pops.
Copy, boy. Listen, Brannett, listen. Limit the first extra. Get set for a second. Second story coming down. The Empire State Building has disappeared.
Okay.
Well, get some pictures down to Brenner in the Empire State.
New York is going piece by piece.
Call the mayor, somebody. Tell him about it. Ask him what he means to do.
Check.
All right. Sweeney.
No such incident in the encyclopedia.
Unprecedented. 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 Lawson and Frankie, you two get cameras. Rush downtown and be on hand in case any other big buildings exit. Copy, boy. Find out how many people are usually in the Empire State.
Check.
Yeah.
Pop, this Frankie. Pennsylvania Station's gone.
Full of people?
Yeah, and trains and everything. There's nothing there but a hole in the ground. I was lucky. I was about a block away and I saw it happen. You said big, so I figured Pennsylvania.
Get the story.
Well, there was a kind of a rumble. And then all of a sudden, the station seemed to cave into itself and it was gone. Oh. A little guy in a swallowtail coat almost knocked me down running away. He was scared to death. Everybody was trying to get away. And right on the corner, one of our boys was shouting our first extra. The whole building just disappeared. That's all. People, trains, everything. You ought to see the hole in the ground.
Get statements. Rush your pictures back here. Don't be a damn photographer all your life.
Okay, Pop.
All right. Pennsylvania Station. Tim, get this for rewrite. About 5 minutes ago, Pennsylvania Station disappeared. People, trains, everything. There's only a hole in the ground. There was a rumble, and then the thing vanished. Seemed to cave into itself. but there's no debris. It's all gone. All gone.
Okay, Pops.
Copy, boy. Pictures of Pennsylvania Station. Brandon, please. Listen, keep adding to that extra. We got pictures of Pennsylvania Station coming. It's, oh, by the way, it's gone.
Ben?
Yeah?
Oh, boy. What a story.
Angles.
Hey, I got a statement from the mayor. He's yelling sabotage. He says he's phoning the governor to call out the militia. He says they can't do this to his town.
All right. Banner number three. Mayor objects. Calls out militia. Story's coming down. All right, roll it out. Spread it out thick. They'll be half panicked by now. So stab in a human interest angle. Make them take it calm.
Check.
All right. Where's that cigarette case? Angles. Two men with swallowtail coats. Eddie, take this lead. Mystery man seen in two catastrophes. A small man with a swallowtail coat was present today at both the vanishing of the tomb and Pennsylvania Station. Was seen to run across the place where the tomb had been and collided with one of our reporters just after Pennsylvania disappeared. Got it?
Got it.
Check.
All right. Now, there's something about that. There's something about that Hannibal Pertwee. Railway station, cigarette case, swallowtail coat.
She's sure gone.
What?
The Empire State. There's nothing but a hole in the ground. There were umpteen thousand people inside. There's no sign of them.
Okay. Do me a story about the state of the city. How calm they're taking it. Smooth them down. Third extra is on its way, and you'll make the lead in the fourth.
Did you do this?
Boss? Well, yeah, sure. What about it?
Why didn't you call me? You know where I eat lunch. How do you know this story is true? What do you mean spreading terror all over town? How is it that we get a paper out so quick when there's nobody else on the streets? If this is a farce, then we'll be in Dutch plenty. Civil and criminal actions.
It takes guts to run a paper.
Well, if that's what it takes, you've got too many. Now we've got to check everything we've printed. If you've got another extra on the rollers, you've got to kill it and find out if it's true.
The third extra is on the street. Listen, I've pinch hit as night editor so often that no one's questioned my right to go ahead.
But you took the authority without even trying to find me?
A story has got to go when it's hot.
And you ran this one so hot that you're driving New York into a panic.
What?
Get out!
What?
I mean it. I said get out. You're through. Finished. Washed up. Today instead of tomorrow.
Well, that was fun while it lasted.
Are you going to take him at his word? Just because you were smart enough not to wait? He's just sore because you did so swell.
Maybe.
You're not going to quit like this, are you?
No, not like this.
Well, I'm very sorry, but I can't ask you in tonight. I'm so busy.
Yeah. I just came after my cigarette case.
Cigarette case?
Yeah, I lost it when I was here before. I would dislike having to part with it permanently. You don't mind if I come in and just take a look, do you?
Why, I...
Here we go. I was just sitting right here in this chair. You don't mind if I look elsewhere?
Yes, I mean... No, I'm very busy. Really, you will have to go.
Oh, but my cigarette case is very valuable to me.
Of course. I appreciate your predicament. But if I had seen it, and if I find it... Oh, dear, what am I saying?
Well, all right. I won't trouble you any further. I can see how upset you are. But what's that in your pocket?
Wonder how that got there.
Yeah, so do I. And now if I could inspect your trains again.
Well, yes, all right. Just come this way.
Oh, damn him. And he broke my cigarette case. Oh. straight.
Well, then. Ain't that awful about them buildings and all, eh? The wickedness of this city is what brought it on. Just yesterday, I says to a gent in here, I says, a town as sinful as this.
Yeah. You mind if I smoke?
As I was saying, a town as sinful as this cannot meet but one fate in the mighty wrath of...
What? The whole bar vanished. Complete with tinder. Well, no. There's the bar. It's only about an inch long. Oh, and there's the bartender. Oh, he doesn't seem to be moving. Well, I'll keep it in my pocket for now. Now, what could have happened?
Taxi!
I need a smoke.
Taxi!
Cap's gone. What's this? Oh, there it is. There it is, a little less than an inch long. I better call the night editor from a phone booth. Yeah, Joe, this is Pop. Look, I got a bar and a taxi in my pocket. Stand by for an extra about midnight.
You, huh? Sleep it off, Pop, and drink one for me.
No. So, they won't believe me, will they? Well, I'll show them. I'll show them.
Let go of me. I won't. Mm-hmm. It's no use. I won't tell you or anybody else. After what they did to me, why should I do anything for them?
I got some items here I found accompanying the vacant spaces in the vicinity of New York on your toy railway system.
I'll have you for burglary. You can't prove anything at all. What if I do have some models of buildings? Can't I make models of what I please?
Yeah, what about those people that you can see in them?
Can't I make people in model form, too?
What? You here again?
Yeah, that's right. And I have...
There's no use begging for that job. We don't need anybody. Now get out or I'll have you thrown out.
I don't think so. Send in Mr. Graw.
I'll blacklist you. Yeah. You'll never work on another paper again.
Yeah, I'll take my chances, all right? Mr. Graw.
Well, here I am. What's this?
Oh, he won't get out. He sent for you. Not me. I didn't.
Well, of all the cheek.
Now, listen, you two. I've been in this business a long time, and I know what a story is worth. You're losing money, and you need circulation. Well, the way to get circulation is to get stories. Now.
No, I won't.
Here on the table. Pennsylvania Station, Grand Central, Grant's Tomb.
Careful.
And the Empire State, and a bar and a taxi.
I won't.
What are these?
Just what you see, the missing buildings.
Preposterous. If you have gone to all this trouble just to make some foolish story.
Oh, I've gone to plenty of trouble, but not to have anything made. These are the real thing.
Rot.
Yeah, well, I'll make you a proposition. I'll restore these to their proper places. If I do that, can I have my job back permanently?
Well, if you can put back what this city has lost, I'll give you your job back. Yes. But why waste our time?
All right, just call Mr. Barstow of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Get him over here on the double, and I'll put the buildings back.
But how?
Just call him, that's all. You can't afford to run the risk of losing this chance.
If you're talking nonsense...
Thank you.
You called me, Grom. By God, I hope you've got some news.
Pop here claims to have your station. He says this is it.
Is this a joke? I mean, that's a perfectly good replica, certainly, but...
Look. This is Hannibal Pertwee. Probably the smartest scientist since Moses.
Oh, you.
So you know him?
Yeah, he used to bother us quite a bit. What is it now?
Ah, we get somewhere. Now, Barstow, if this gentleman replaces your Pennsylvania station and these other objects, will you make a contract with him?
About his ideas on freight?
Huh?
I don't know which is the craziest statement, that you'll restore the buildings or that anything he can think up will affect our freight, but go ahead.
Here, I typed it up. Sign it.
All right, that's done.
All right. So, this is what you've been begging for all this time. You got it now. Go ahead.
You mean that you really consider my propositions? That you may utilize my findings?
I've said so in this paper.
Well, you see, gentlemen, my idea was to reduce freight in size so that it could be shipped easily. And so I analyzed the possibilities of infinite acceleration.
All right. Spare the lecture. Get busy. They won't understand anything but action.
Action. Yes. May I have the cigarette case?
Sure.
Yeah. It was very ingenious, I thought. I had been waiting for this very thing. Mm-hmm. Apparatus would have been noticed, you see. But this, this was perfect. One can stand on the edge of a crowd and press the buttons both together, and the atomic bubble within is set to nearly infinite acceleration. It spins out and engulfs the first whole object it embraces and sets it spinning in four dimensions. Of course, as the object spins at a certain speed, it is accordingly reduced in size. Now, Einstein once
said... All right. Just push the button in the direction of the tiny taxi.
It compresses time as well as space. I just released the bubble.
Yeah, what address, buddy? Where the hell am I?
Cabby, yeah, I tell you what. You step back here out of the way. Do your stuff, Hannibal.
Okay.
Hey, my cab!
Yeah, that's all right. We'll make your cab grow up shortly, down in the street where it belongs. Frankie, you and Lawson, get some cameras. Freeman, you call the mayor and tell him to gather around for the fun. Sweeney, you write up an extra lead, telling the city is all well, and I'll knock out a story on this.
No, you won't.
Oh, wait a minute. You said in front of witnesses...
I don't care what I said. I've suddenly got... an idea. Who got out those extras so fast yesterday?
Well,
Pop did.
Yeah, well, at first I believed Calborn, but when I got to thinking it over, after I found out how fast they really had come...
Well, no, wait a minute. That Calborn didn't mean nothing by it. He's just a little young, that's all.
Pop, you can't have his job.
Well, I didn't say I wanted...
Pop, I've got a better spot for you than that. My job. Huh? Your managing editor. Maybe you can make this son-in-law of mine amount to something if you train him right.
Managing editor?
Yes. I'm going to slip out of the job. I need rest. And so, Mr. Managing Editor, I leave you to the editions.
Well.
Hooray! Hooray!
All right. Now what are you waiting for? We got an extra edition to get out, and that means work. Hannibal, you trot along with Frankie and Lawson. They'll help you put the buildings back. And listen, Frankie, don't miss any shots. Copy boy.
Okay, Pop.
Welcome, RF Daily, Travis Oates, and Roger Scott.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be here, indeed.
Hello, everybody out there in podcast land.
Absolutely. Now, being mindful that this is the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast, and I always try to provide some tips to help make better writers and artists, this is a question and answer that we're going to have with the actors that will help give you some tips on how to make yourself a better writer, and if you're an illustrator, how to better portray a story. So first of all, from your perspective and in reference also to the story we just listened to, what makes a good story from an actor's perspective?
For me, it's...
And this is Roger Scott speaking.
Yeah, this is Roger Scott. For me, it's transportation. It's transportation into another world that the writer creates. They set the parameters. It takes us out of our daily lives. It moves us into a world that we may think sometimes that we're familiar with, but might move us deeper into it so that we understand it better. Or it could move us into a fantastic world, like the professor was a thief. And now we're in a world where, wow, something like that could happen. Well, in the writer's hands, in this case, in L. Ron Hubbard's hands, the answer is yes, because he creates parameters that are believable. Even if it's believable in the gossamer world that he creates. And so it's a fun place to go into. So transportation for me makes a big difference.
This is Travis Oates adding to that. I think as well, a story that has universal and evergreen appeal is one that also relates to the universe that you live in, you know, the time that you live in. I think the best stories are relatable, whether you're in 1940 or 2022. And I think many of L. Ron Hubbard's stories, and this one included, have reflections of the world that we live in within, you know, the boundaries of the story that's being told.
And this is RF Daily. And I'd like to add on to Travis's thought on that. The thing that I love about this story in particular is that the prose transports you directly into the time. The way they speak, the language, the idioms, the slang, and it's not only the time chronologically, but it's also the place, you know, the newspaper business at that time. And L. Ron Hubbard knew all of these things intimately, and he was able to communicate them so well. It was pretty much easy for us to jump on that sled and ride uphill, which is an odd thing to do on a sled, but it somehow worked.
That's great. Thank you. Now, I've done a lot of interviews. Like I said, this is number 200, and I've talked to a lot of authors, and they all have different ideas of how to create dialogue, you know, what they've done. I know when I've talked a lot with Orson Scott Card, he says, what's your problem? You talk all the time, you know? And I think some authors get stifled. Just they're trying, instead of just like, how do you talk to somebody? They try to imagine what it's like to talk to somebody, which is really silly. So as an actor, you're stuck with reciting the dialogue that's given you. What have you found that's worked or not worked in terms of creating dialogue that's actually easy to perform, that feels natural to perform, which enhances obviously your performance? I'll let Travis, you can go on this one here.
Sure. And I should note that my primary job is actually as a script doctor. So I often go in to existing scripts and change the dialogue so that it sounds more natural and sounds like it is more believable coming out of someone's mouth. But as an actor, I mean, when you're given dialogue, you know, it's kind of similar in a weird way to, you know, if you're playing someone, the bad guy, if you're playing someone who's evil, you know, people always say, you know, how can you play someone effectively? And you have to find, you know, the humanity and something to relate even with the most evil of person that you're doing. So with the dialogue, you know, even if the dialogue, when you initially read the dialogue, if it doesn't fit into your brain, you have to find a way to find the flow and to find the pattern and the patter of that dialogue, you know, especially when you're dealing with dialogue that was written, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, you have to kind of do a little bit of research and maybe immerse yourself into that time period so that you're better able to find what that author was trying to impart and in what way that dialogue, an author, for example, that is very hard sometimes to translate their dialogue on the screen is Stephen King, because it's written in that Boston, you know, upper New England accents. And sometimes it can be very painful to hear people try to duplicate that. And often, you know, when you get an actor who really keys into it, they have no problem with it. So I think, you know, anytime you're dealing with something that is a period, I think part of it is just trying to immerse yourself in that period mentally.
Good. Thank you. RF, any thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. But the one thing that we also have to remember is that although there are certainly some differences in the way people spoke and the words they spoke at different times, I think you'll find even Shakespeare, when Shakespeare is spoken with an understanding that you would have if you were speaking contemporary English, it communicates just as well as contemporary English does to a modern person. The intentions are the most important thing. So if you're communicating the ideas and the thoughts and the emotions, I think that probably takes precedence over any other aspect of speaking the dialogue.
And I think that's key, what he just said there. If you listen to people who are doing Shakespeare and it's more like they're reciting a poem, you know, without thinking through the process of what's being said, instead of reciting it like it's beautiful prose rather than somebody actually speaking it, that's when Shakespeare becomes painful to watch instead of glorious to watch.
Got it. Roger?
Yeah, I was going to say, along with both what RF was saying and Travis was saying, first of all, on Travis's thing, like if you're playing a bad guy character, first remember the bad guy never thinks, or the evil guy, he doesn't think he's evil.
Right.
Right. He's right. Playing what it is. Tony Soprano didn't think he was evil. He was doing what was expedient for what was necessary to be done. And that's the way bad guys are too. We can perceive them as evil in terms of what they're doing. But getting back to what RF was saying, the human condition is behind all of it. And so you have to find the human condition behind the guy. Like the first time that I meet Pop as the reporter in The Professor Was a Thief, and I find out that he's been sacked, there's a couple things as an actor and doing the dialogue that go through my mind. First of all, he's being sacked because, what, he's in his 50s? They're getting rid of anybody over 50? So L. Ron Hubbard has introduced ageism very early on in the story. And one of the things I think about when he says he's being sacked as my character is I'm thinking, oh, wait a second, how old am I? How much time do I have? All right, okay, so this is the way it works. All right, then I've got, I don't know, maybe I'm in my 30s, I've got 15 years or something like that, and then I'm going to be out the door too. And so there's a sympathy, but there's also an empathy coming from my character in terms of what he's dealing with in his present day reality. And I think that kind of human condition behind the words is what brings the dialogue to life. And sometimes writers miss. A friend of mine once told me of an episode of Mad Men in which they were talking about, of course, that was set, you know, in the 50s and so on. And one of the characters says, when they, in summation to what's going on, she says, well, it is what it is. And it was like, they didn't use that phrase then. And it's amazing that it got by the people who both wrote and did the story that, you know, that didn't fit. And right. if it doesn't fit, the perilous thing is it takes you out of the story, because now you're starting to think about the phrase that didn't fit and you're not listening to what the other actors are saying because it pulls you out. Now, The Professor Was a Thief pulls you in because the human condition is there. The words are there, as RF said, the idioms and so on of the time are there. So you are immersed totally in that world. Later on, at the end of the story, when Pop's character gets elevated to the guy who's running the whole thing, we find another aspect of the human condition, and that the guy who was sacking him was the son-in-law. So we've got nepotism in the story too. And those are things that fit in that make the whole thing rounded out in the human condition, the way people operate and the reasons why people operate the way they do. I love that.
An acting coach one time gave me a great piece of advice because I was dealing with a character that was kind of difficult, not a very nice character. And it was a character, this was in a play, and it was a character who wasn't a huge part, and I was having a hard time figuring out how to do it. And the acting coach told me that in every piece of work that you're doing as an actor, the character you're playing is not only the hero of that story, but the central character of that story from their perspective, right? From their perspective, this is the story that's being told about that character. You know, and that's also another thing to keep in mind, like when you're doing dialogue as an actor, is that, you know, from their perspective, this is their story. They're the hero. You know, they're the central character. And that can change how you do certain dialogue. Pertwee in the story that we just heard, Pertwee is the central hero of that story from his perspective, you know. So
that's the way you do the dialogue. Yeah, that's very, very good on that. A while ago, speaking with Phil Proctor, who is another amazing actor, talked about how he really specifically appreciated Aaron Hubbard's dialogue, his knack for doing dialogue back in the 50s, 30s, 40s in these pulp fiction stories, but also when he wrote Battlefield Earth and Mission Earth, because Phil was in all that has been in so many of the different stories. And I think all three of you have been in, RF definitely narrated a lot, but I think you've also been in various stories. But Phil was talking about how Aaron Hubbard's dialogue was just one of those rare instances where he doesn't feel a need to have to change words. Sometimes when he gets dialogue from certain authors, he feels, I can't say these words. It's not right. And he never had to do that with Aaron Hubbard. Do any of you have any comments on that from any of this story, as well as any other ones that maybe you've done of Mr. Hubbard's?
If I may, I did narrate a whole slew of these stories. And of course, I found all of the dialogue to be believable and understandable and really very easy to perform. But as the narrator, I was the voice of L. Ron Hubbard in a way, or at least the storyteller L. Ron Hubbard. And his thoughts were, well, as they say, if it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. His thoughts were so coherent and so descriptive. It was, and so real, so true, it was very easy for me to tell the story in a way that makes sense and communicates to the audience in such a way that they can become part of the story themselves.
Right. Roger, you're going to say something?
Yeah. I was just going to add to that the language in the story, the flow of the words is so precise. RF is exactly right. You don't need to add anything to it. I can only assume that he was a good jigsaw puzzle worker too, because all the pieces fit in the characters and in what they're saying, the way they're saying it. And so it's, you know, it's a treat as an actor to take the words in front of you and, you know, play the play and just do the words. They're right there.
That's great. Now, in terms of, okay, so listeners out there listening to this podcast, the idea of writing dialogue, have you all experienced something that, like, the difference between good dialogue and bad dialogue, or what makes something really work for you versus not, that you can say anything you have to say on that, Travis?
Well, a professional actor never has bad dialogue.
Because
you find a way to make that good dialogue. It's all in the eye of the beholder. But, you know, obviously, since my job for a living is to take dialogue and to change it, I have seen some, shall you say, difficult dialogue to say, and changed it to dialogue that's easier to say. But, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I love working on stuff, the older, the better. The problem is, one of the ways to make modern dialogue sound better is to make it less articulate, which is sad to say. But, you know, I love, you know, I just worked on a Western not too long ago. And even in the Western where you think, you know, these people are somehow dumber than we are because they are from a society which, you know, is more crude technologically. But their words have a lyricism to them and kind of a beautiful flow to them. Even the inarticulate people in those Westerns, it's still a pattern and a flow. I mean, you were just talking about Shakespeare, RF, and Shakespeare, he was often writing, the characters in there were supposed to be like the lower class individuals. You know, they were talking the people's English. It was supposed to be guttural, you know, English by societal terms. And yet it had such a lyricism and such a beauty to it. And, you know, such a beautiful way of talking comparatively.
People were a lot more literate. When I say literate, I mean books had a more central place in people's experience of learning and so forth. They didn't.
Even the illiterate people talked more literate.
Yes, know? Well, they you but know, they listened. They, had a... they listened to people who were literate, though.
Right.
One of the things.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, RF. One of the things that brought all of this to my mind immediately when you started talking about that, Travis, and how you have to make things almost more inarticulate for the ear today. I go back to that Ken Burns Civil War series when they were reading those letters from Confederate privates and Union privates back to their families and stuff. And oh my gosh, the writing in those letters and the words and whatnot, you go, whoa, we have lost a whole bunch of stuff because these people had a way of communicating in words that were so poetic.
There's a comedian on YouTube that, in the same style of the letters from the Civil War, does letters from the most recent war. back. And it's really hilarious to hear like people talking about modern things in those terms because it's just so ridiculous and it just sounds so, I don't know, petty compared to the things that they were talking about.
And here's another thought on that same thing. In those days, they had to dip a pen into an inkwell and they had to write. And it was a time-consuming thing, which gave them time to think. They weren't tweeting with their thumbs, you know? So they considered what they were saying, I think, a lot more than people who are doing it now.
And may I say that was a lot more difficult to do in the middle of the frozen winter when people were shooting at you.
Yeah.
But it's really amazing that some of those letters were sent, period.
It's amazing their iPhones worked at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, in terms of so a writer or an aspiring author here listening to this, what would be some of your cautionary advice that you could provide to writing dialogue?
I would say the biggest thing, since I see a lot of dialogue that is being paid to be rewritten, do not overwrite. Write the dialogue that is necessary for the scene. Don't write dialogue. Don't explain to me something that you're doing. You know, that happens a lot too in scripts, you know. You know, they're doing something in a scene and they're explaining what they're doing at the same time. Also, don't write a whole lot when you're alone. People don't usually talk to themselves. You know, even in novels, that's usually an internal dialogue. Just let the action play out. That would be the biggest overall things that I would say. Also, I should mention that I did at the age of 17, I did try out. I joined the contest of Writers of the Future, and you guys looked it up, I believe, and actually found my submission many years ago. And I would also say to those people who are trying. My writing was horrible when I was 17 and I deserved to not get an award. But you know, as you get better and better, don't stop attempting. Don't, you know, keep those submissions going.
Thank you. Yeah. We had one person that had been entering, you know, for literally decades. We've had many winners have been entering for decades to build the craft and work on it. And sometimes you have to let your skin thicken a little bit because, you're definitely going to be experiencing a lot of rejections, which is why the contest is so important as well, because you've got like-minded individuals that are totally willing to do whatever they can to help you and give you that assist. And that's, I mean, the three of you right now talking, that's what that is. You're helping these aspiring writers. Here's something that, you know, just something as simple as writing dialogue that is convincing can make the difference between a story selling and not selling. You know, I mean, it's a pretty big part, but it absolutely will. Bob?
Yes. I'd like to very badly paraphrase and quote L. Ron Hubbard on this. Just write, he says. Just write. Don't sit there and edit yourself as you're writing. Just write it. Write it. Get it done. And then if you need to edit it, you go back. But don't sit there and spend too much time on a sentence, because you know what the intention is. Just write it so that it communicates.
Exactly.
I used to do a thing where when I was writing something, I would end my day of writing in the middle of a sentence, and then wait overnight and reread what I had written, because the next day it looks like it was written by somebody else other than myself. And then so you read through there and you get to the point where you're in the middle of the sentence and it's like, oh, and it just takes off from there. And you know how you're going to complete the sentence from there. One of the things that if I could give some advice to the writers, and L. Ron Hubbard obviously did it in this book, he went the other way. Like he said, they were doing big words and cataclysmic blowups and stuff, and he went inside. Okay. He went into an unpredictable world where you shrink things down. So when you're creating a story, we talk about Jules Verne. Certainly L. Ron Hubbard has to fit in that category. They're creating fantastic things. And we find out later on that some of those things were predictive. They were things that did happen in some form. So when you're creating a story like L. Ron Hubbard did in this one, and Professor Was a Thief, think about your story. What might happen in the future that you could create in the now? That is something that is possible in the future. I think about this shrinking of things down, and I watched a special on this show where a fella had come up with an idea. You know, those big cargo bins that go on the ships and stuff that you see all stacked up and whatnot. The problem is when you get everything emptied, you're transporting empty cargo bins. Well, the ship only holds so much. Well, this guy came up with a way of putting those great big squares, and with mechanical operation, he shrank them down till they fit together almost like a big metal suitcase. And instead of being as wide and as long as they were only like 3 feet wide, with the whole thing shrinking into its And I couldn't help but think of that when I thought of L. Ron Hubbard's thing of shrinking things down. And this guy came up with a way of shrinking things down so that there was more room for more cargo bins. It was amazing. So in itself, The Professor Was a Thief was predictive in terms of something that, you know, could possibly happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And let me also say, as a writer, about the Writers of the Future contest, there used to be, back in the day, literally hundreds of places where you could submit a short story. Fantasy short story. There were all kinds of things. There were things called magazines. Many of you listening probably haven't heard of those, but there were a lot of them.
I think that's just an urban legend.
Yeah. But, you know, Treasure, you know, and look, I'm not paid to say this. I'm not a part of the organization. They turned me down the one time that I tried to submit something. But I will say, like, Treasure organizations like this, because there's so few places nowadays where you can write something that's a short story in science fiction or fantasy, submit it, and actually get it published. That is just so rare these days. You know, published on paper, you know, in a form that you can own, not on the internet. And you know, that's pretty cool that you guys are still doing that, and it's still being, you know, you have judges that are legit. You know, you're not. It's cool that you guys are still doing that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. It's we're carrying forward the original mission statement as given by Ron Hubbard to provide that means for aspiring artists to have their chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. And now with over 800 winners over the last 38 years, this coming April, we will have volume 39 released. but we just started year 40. We're in the first quarter of the competition for year number 40. So it's amazing what's going on. We've had, you know, the best of the best of science fiction fantasy authors as our judges. And then the same thing with the illustrator, with the artist as well. It's there is nothing else like it because it's the contest is free to enter. It's blind judged. So the judges only ever see the story or the art and a number. They have no idea if you're male, female, your nationality, ethnicity, sex, anything at all. It's just strictly by the merit of your work that you will win. And
did
now
you hear him? Did you hear him say free? Free to enter. Right. That, yeah, that also that
means something too.
That is a big deal because a lot of places, you know, that say they're legit, they're going to ask you for, you know, $250, you know, to give it a shot. And free to enter, that's a big thing for all you people out there who want to be writers, and especially in the science fiction age. Every quarter, you should be sending a submission into these guys.
In addition to that, not only is it published, but there are cash prizes, ladies and gentlemen. Cash prizes.
Yep, absolutely.
I'm just going to sit back and listen to you guys go back and forth.
Yeah.
We're fans. Yeah. What can I say?
Yeah. I mean, and it's all been funded since day one by L. Ron Hubbard from his estate. So the 12 winners every year of the writer contest and the 12 winners every year from the illustrator contest are flown out to Hollywood for a week-long workshop. This past year, they were entertained by amazing and talented actors, including the three of you, receiving one of these stories. But they receive a workshop, and then we have an amazing gala award ceremony. It's referred to as the Oscars of science fiction. We have the red carpet. We have usually about 20, 30 media there to interview the winners. And we have it's a who's who of science fiction and fantasy there in the audience as the winners get their awards. And this year it was, we had over 3 million people listening to the award ceremony as it was happening live. And like I said, this podcast now is up to 1.5 million listens per episode because it really is a continuation of what was originally intended by Mr. Hubbard when he created this in 1983. And we have such great people involved with it that it continues to grow and expand. We have entries from over 175 countries now that come in. Wow. And it's just one of those things that's really amazingly prophetic on his part in creating this thing. But then just by the fact that, you know, you three, what you have to say just shows that it does what it says it's going to do, you know. And we've got, like I said, over 800 winners now that will talk about, you know, the success that they've achieved from this.
And correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I don't think I am. This is often the gateway to a larger career for those people too, in that industry.
Absolutely. Multiple judges are actually past winners of the contest. Huh. You know, major New York Times bestselling authors. It's interesting how someone will judge themselves. They'll disqualify themselves before they even have a chance to enter. And it's just so wrong. And so another thing that we tried to do with this, and which, you know, Travis, which you suggested a few moments ago too, is just enter the contest. You should be doing it every quarter, whether you're a writer or an artist. Let the judges tell you if you're a winner, but the judges will also tell you, look at, okay, you got some ways to go. You'll never get judged and said, don't, you know, you'll never get told from writers, illustrators of the future, don't give up your day job. That will never come out of any communication from this organization. The whole thing is encouraging, and that's what it's all about.
Hey, look, last month I just sold my 7th Hollywood script and I lost the competition. Just imagine if you won it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and you have at least twice as many.
Well, to quote a famous copywriter from a Madison Avenue advertising firm back in the early 60s, it is what it is.
So, yeah, it's been great. So we've got the last minute or two. Anything that you three gentlemen would like to say before we wrap up this part of our podcast?
Yeah, I'd like to echo L. Ron Hubbard's words. Just write, 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 write.
Good.
Yeah. Mike Rowe has a podcast, and his mom, now in her 80s, wrote every day, still writes every day. She finally published her first book in her 80s. It was a New York Times bestseller called Vacuuming in the Nude and Other interesting ways of getting attention. And now she's already on her third book. And, you know, she just never stopped. She never gave up.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I would say this to aspiring writers. The title of writer is something that exists in your mind. You don't have to sold something to be a writer. All you have to do to be a writer is write. So don't let people tell you you're not a writer. Don't let people tell you you're not legitimate. Just keep writing if that's your passion. You're a writer if you say you are.
Yeah.
And if you pursue writing in its most pure sense, it's all about communicating. And
yeah.
If you're communicating, you're a writer.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We've also been syndicated on the United Public Radio Network, where you can find these podcasts as well. Writers of the Future series can be purchased wherever books are sold in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Australia, and South Africa, and available everywhere via Amazon.com. We are especially appreciative of our sponsor, Carnation, for supporting this podcast. Carnation has been making delicious milk products for over a century and is still going strong. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, R.F. Daly, Travis Oates, and Roger Scott for helping me celebrate our 200th episode. Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Gibbon, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. If you've been listening to this podcast or are new to it, first off, thank you very much. I would also appreciate it if you took a moment to follow the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. Today's guest is international bestselling author Elizabeth Wien, best known for her novel, Codename Verity, whereas for me, she is best known as A Wind in Rise of Future Volume 3, but we're going to get to that in a moment. Hello and welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. I'm talking to you from Scotland. It's nice to be here.
It's very nice to talk to you all the way over there in Scotland. And before I butcher anything else, I'll just leave it with that right there. So, now you were a winner in Volume 3.
Volume 9.
Oh, it was Volume 9. Okay. Mm-hmm. Winner in Volume 9 with your story, Fire. And you had your fellow winners there. Then it was Sean Williams, Eric Flint, Stoney Compton, Kathleen Dalton Woodbury, Brian Lee Durfee, and Carolyn Long. Are you still in touch with any of those folks?
I am occasionally in touch with them. I'm friends with them on Facebook. I am friends with Carolyn Long and Stoney Compton on Facebook. And I actually bumped into Sean Williams in 2013 at the Brisbane Literary Festival in Australia, which was an amazing meeting because I was very, very excited to meet him again after all those years. Mm-hmm. And he didn't actually realize who I was. And he had read Codename Verity and had loved it. So he was excited to meet me. And it was only sort of after we'd said, oh wow, I like your writing, that we realized we'd both been on the Writers of the Future, award slate. Yeah.
Wow, that's great. And then it was unfortunate with the recent passing of Eric Flint.
Yes.
That was sad. He was he had been a judge, as is Sean Williams. But he had been a judge in the contest. And that was tough. He spent a lot of his efforts helping aspiring writers and including them in his series and in his publishing house. He had helped give them a start, boot in the pants, whatever, to get their careers launched. He's a really, really nice guy. So I'm just curious, is there any particular aspect to being a winner of Writers of the Future that you feel played a positive role in your trajectory as a writer? And if so, how so?
Well, obviously being told that your writing is any good is always, a great boost. But for me, what was really the most wonderful thing about it was being able to get together with the other authors, because I was out there in the blue at that point. I really didn't know. I knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know how you talk to anybody, you know, how mm-hmm. you exchanged ideas and sob stories with people. Mm-hmm. And having the chance to work with all these people was really life-changing for me, eye-opening. And of course, I didn't really know much about the science fiction fantasy field anyway, and they all said, oh, come to World Fantasy Con, and they said, you know, do you know this person, do you know that person, have you submitted stuff to this magazine? And it was as I say, it was life-changing.
That's great. And then I think that the story you wrote was, what was this relationship to Winter Prince?
Well, I was although I submitted the story that I wrote, Fire, to the competition legitimately, I did not have a published novel or a mm-hmm. published story at all at that point. I was new to the field. By the time that the award ceremony came around, my first book had already been published. And that was, yeah. So it was actually in the same month. So it was like, I felt like, you know, my ship had come in at that point.
For sure.
And the Winter Prince was a sort of Arthurian fantasy focusing on King Arthur's son Mordred and his stormy relationship with his siblings, who I'd made up. And Fire was a kind of mini sequel to The Winter Prince, a little epilogue. And it was because these characters were still, you know, very much alive in my head, and I didn't want to let them go. And so I wrote it almost as soon as I finished writing The Winter Prince. And that was the story that I submitted.
That's a cool story how that works. Go ahead, though.
No, I was going to say it came second in my quarter, which meant that it did not go on to be entered in, you know, the grand prize competition. Right. And I was so glad that it hadn't, because honestly, because if I had been competing with these other authors for another prize, I don't think I would have enjoyed my experience there as much. I would have been, you know, oh, I hope I win. I hope I win. And who's the competition? And instead I could just kind of sit back and relax and admire everybody and have fun.
Let's see. That was the year that Carowind won. And just an interesting anecdote on that particular phenomenon you're talking about there. Jerry Purnell used to love going around, and once he knew who the grand prize winner was, he'd go up to him and say, don't worry, it's not you. And so he'd be totally all, you know, just chill now, because, okay, it's not me. The pressure's off. I don't have to worry about it. Is it me or not? And then they'd be called, the camera would be on them, and you just see them totally flustered, like, you know, trying to register, because they'd been told they weren't it, and now they're being told they are it. And he used to love playing that game of...
Well, Carowind and I, during that week, became like kind of instant best friends. Mm-hmm. We were, you know, we've drifted apart in the 40 years or whatever it is, 30 years, yeah. I think, since then. But we really hit it off very well. She said at one point, oh, I feel like I found a sister. And so we were kind of like arm in arm. And at that point, we were both pretty young. Yeah. And, you know, the cute girl couple walked.